Having examined the perils of pride, let's look briefly now at how anger, even so-called righteous indignation, could harm us. Within AA, I suppose we shall always quarrel a good bit. Mostly, I think, about how to do the greatest good for the greatest number of drunks. We shall have our childish spats and snits over small questions of money management and who's going to run our groups for the next 6 months. Any bunch of growing children, and that is what we are, would hardly be in character if they did less. These are the growing pains of infancy, and we actually thrive on them. Surmounting such problems in AA's rather rugged school of life is a healthy exercise. But there are nevertheless certain areas where anger and contention could prove to be our undoing. We know this because stronger societies than our own have been undone. The whole modern world is in fact coming apart as never before because of political and religious strife, because men blindly pursue wealth, fame, and personal power regardless of the consequences to anyone, even to themselves. These are the destructive drives that are inevitably spurred by self-justification, and in all their disastrous collisions, they are powered by righteous indignation, then by unreasoning anger, and finally by blind fury. With the most heartfelt gratitude, I can report that we have never yet had to endure any such trials by fire in AA. In all these 20 marvelous years, no such thing as religious or political dissension has touched us. Very few have tried to exploit AA for wealth or fame or personal power. We have had great problems, but they have always been resolved. Never has a grave issue cut across and scarred the face of this far-flung fellowship. But again, this is no earned virtue of ours. Too many of us in our drinking days have suffered the terrible penalties of proud and angry pursuits to forget them now. These very pains have been the beginning of whatever wisdom we have since incorporated in AA's 12 traditions. Hence, I feel confident that these forces of destruction will never rule among us. We are prepared to pay the price of peace. We will make every personal sacrifice necessary to ensure the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. We will do this because we have learned to love God and one another. As these meetings began on a theme of gratitude, so should they end. We give thanks to our Heavenly Father, who, through so many friends and through so many means and channels, has allowed us to construct this wonderful edifice of the Spirit in which we are now dwelling. It seems as though He had directed us to construct this cathedral, whose foundations already rest upon the corners of the earth. On its great floor, 200,000 of us are now sustained in peace, and long since we have inscribed thereon our 12 steps of recovery. The older ones among us have seen the side walls of this cathedral going up, and one by one they have seen the buttresses of the AA tradition set in place to contain us in unity for so long as God may will it so. And now eager hearts and hands have lifted the spire of our cathedral into its place. That spire bears the name of service. May it ever point straight upward toward God. 4. Medicine looks at Alcoholics Anonymous. Without its friends of medicine, Alcoholics Anonymous might never have been born. It was from the medical profession that we of AA learned the physical and emotional nature of our malady. Today, thousands of physicians throughout the world are working in closest cooperation with us. In the following section, we introduce two of these medical friends, both of whom freely gave us their warmest endorsements at AA's 20th anniversary celebration in St. Louis in July 1955. Here, we reproduce the proceedings of the 20th anniversary convention's medical panel. The first address was given by Dr. W.W. Bauer of the American Medical Association. This was followed by a paper read by Dr. Harry M. Tebow, AA's first friend in the profession of psychiatry. Both physicians gave their view of Alcoholics Anonymous and told how they cooperate with us and how AA has influenced their own thinking and practice. This session opened with an AA member, Dr. Clarence P., in the chair. AA Chairman Dr. Clarence P. To be transplanted from a small town of 9,000 people into an auditorium like this is a little bit overwhelming. And to be presented with the array of talent that we have here this morning is also a little overwhelming. You have done me a great honor in permitting me to act as your chairman. We will run this pretty much as a medical meeting. We will dispense with all formalities and get down to the business of medicine and AA. This morning, first, we have with us the greatest of living AAs, who in his humility has refused a Doctor of Laws degree. It seems to me that this was a great decision. I will only say, thank God he passed this way and that we have known him. There are no words to describe our feelings toward Bill. Bill, I know you all sense that this is a very significant meeting on a very significant occasion, because it has to do with our relations to the men of medicine. AA can be likened to a temple supported by three pillars. One is religion, another is medicine, and the third is our own experience as people who have suffered from alcoholism. Medicine, in its broad aspects, includes the science of the mind and its effect upon the body, as well as the effect of a physical malady upon the mind. In our two distinguished guests, Dr. Bauer and Dr. Thiebaud, we have here people truly expert in each of these departments. It would be a sorry day for AA if we ever came to think that we had a monopoly on fixing drunks. I think we ought to encourage every research in this area, whether it concerns the mind or the body. As individuals, we often ought to associate ourselves with such enterprises. As excuse makers and rationalizers, we drunks are champions. It is the business of the psychiatrist to get behind our excuses and to find the deeper causes for our conduct. Though uninstructed in psychiatry, we can, after a little time in AA, see that our motives have not been what we thought they were, and that we have been motivated by forces unknown to us. Therefore, we ought to look with the deepest respect, interest, and profit upon the findings of psychiatry, remembering that up to now, the psychiatrists have been far more tolerant of us than we have been of them. So, we thank them for the steadfast friendship and support which they have given us in nearly every quarter of the profession. When it comes to the general practitioner or specialist in the chemistry of the body, his findings, too, ought to be made use of by us as individuals. Of course, as a movement, we should never presume to intrude on the province of medicine. The practice of medicine is for doctors. The teaching of formal religion is for clergymen. So let us modestly fill our role. Let us make our link, the once missing one, strong. And let's thank God for folks like Dr. Bauer and Dr. Thiebaud. Chairman, on this morning's program, I have shifted my own responsibilities. I have had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Earl M. from San Francisco. Without ever having met this gentleman before, but having had some previous correspondence with him, I feel as though I had known him for years. I'm going to ask him to act as a co-chairman to introduce our next speaker. Let me present Dr. Earl M. Dr. Earl M., fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous and distinguished guests, my remarks will be brief. We are indeed fortunate to have with us a man of the caliber that you are about to hear. He is one of the men in an exceedingly high position in the American Medical Association, one who carries you and me very close to his heart. We could ask for no better ally than the next speaker to confirm and strengthen the already growing friendship between AA and the medical profession. It is a deep pleasure and a great honor to introduce you to my boss and your and my friend, Dr. W. W. Bauer. Dr. W. W. Bauer, thank you, Doctor, for that gracious introduction. I want to assure you that I am nobody's boss. I'm just one of the hired hands of the American Medical Association. Or perhaps I should say, a perambulating loudspeaker. I think my status in the association was expressed one day at an annual meeting in Atlantic City when someone asked me at what hotel I was staying. I mentioned the hotel, and he said, Oh, you're not staying at such and such a hotel where the heads are. You're staying with the shoulders. As a perambulating loudspeaker, I have faced innumerable audiences. One of my staff told me not so long ago that I had made over 1,000 speeches, which is a magnificent tribute to the long-suffering of the American people. Ordinarily, I take an audience in my stride. But I had an invitation about a year ago, when the AMA met in San Francisco, to address an open meeting of AA in the downtown area of that city. And I admit that I never suffered more trepidation in all my life than I did in anticipation of meeting that audience, because I didn't see any good reason why I should be standing up there talking to UAAs. I reminded myself of the young rector in the Episcopal Church to which I belonged. He was consecrated bishop, which was, of course, a great event in the life of a young Episcopal clergyman. After the solemn service of consecration, there was a banquet, and the speaker's table was raised high on a platform so we could all see the new bishop. He was given some very fine tributes, and when it came to his turn to respond, he said, "I feel like the slightly inebriated gentleman on a bright moonlight night who walked out onto the middle of a bridge, looked down at the water, saw the moon reflected there, shook his head, and remarked to himself, 'How in hell did I get way up here?'" I don't feel quite so apprehensive this time, because that audience of AA's proved to be just like any other audience. They were very kind and considerate to the speaker. They listened to him with courtesy, and they were even good enough to tell him afterward that they liked him. But the reason why I am much more at home this time is because of what happened to my wife, who accompanied me on that day. After the meeting, we were standing in a group with the people in charge and with other AA's, and I suppose guests, and as we were chatting, a gentleman joined the group and was introduced to Ron, and when he saw my wife, he looked at her and said, "Where have you been? It's been 2 years since you attended a meeting." This was particularly good because my wife is practically a teetotaler. My experience with AA goes back to the days when I used to put radio shows on the NBC network every week, and I had the privilege of putting on a show under the guidance and direction of one of your members in the Chicago area. From that time on, I began to understand a little of what AA was all about. Of course, a person like me can never understand it fully. I am not a psychiatrist like Dr. Tevo, so my practical knowledge is only that of a practitioner. I'm not a member of AA, so I do not have the background of experience that you have, and I am quite serious when I say I feel most humble in this position before a group of people like you. All I can do is to try to express to you the feeling of the medical profession, a feeling which has been growing steadily throughout the life of your organization and which now, I believe, may be said to be fully crystallized, a feeling that AA has a very large and important part of such answers as we possess to the problem of alcoholism. We know, of course, that the alcoholic is a sick person. That is a very simple phrase. It is today a phrase that is widely and generally accepted. And yet you and I know that it was not so long ago that the alcoholic was regarded as a nuisance, a pest, a person who could snap out of it if he really wanted to. He was regarded as a spoiled brat and as a no good. Today we know that he is an individual who is sick. And we know that he is sick in an area of which our understanding is perhaps the least of any area in medicine, namely, illness of the emotions. We are, in some respects today, in the same position with regard to emotional illness that we were 50 years ago with regard to tuberculosis. My memory does not extend quite that far back. I have been out of medical school only 39 years, but from earlier literature, I know that the idea persisted in the minds of some people that tuberculosis, an infectious disease which attacks people through no fault of their own, was a disgrace. Families often hid the tubercular person, just as they cover up for the alcoholic today. I can remember very well, and so can every doctor on this platform, when we had the same attitude toward cancer. Cancer was regarded as a stigma, as a blight, something to be hidden, because it was a reflection upon the family. Today, we know that cancer is a misfortune, and we are beginning now to realize that we must adopt the same attitude toward mental and emotional illnesses that we have slowly and painfully adopted toward tuberculosis and cancer. Illness of the emotions is no more something to be ashamed of than is illness of the body. We should no more hesitate to consult a psychiatrist, except for the scarcity of these important specialists, than we should hesitate to consult an orthopedist for a sore foot. There is so much in attitudes. A movie star of a day gone by, Clara Bow, is credited with the statement that if she said her foot hurt, everyone was sympathetic. But if she said, "My feet are killing me," they laughed. It's all in the matter of attitude, and we must learn to consult the psychiatrist with the same attitude that we do any other specialist, without a feeling of shame, without a feeling that it is a stigma. There are certain phrases that physicians are compelled to use that we must learn to understand and to accept and to compensate for. We have to learn in medicine, and the public as a whole is going to have to learn of the tremendous individual differences among people. Differences in resistance, for example. Some people tire more easily than others. Some people fall victims to infection more easily than others because of differences in their body chemistry. There are marked differences, as you know, in the intelligence of people, and we must also learn to recognize that there are differences in emotional stability. There are some who can take it better than others. Being able to take it is generally regarded as a virtue, and so it is. It's a fine thing, if one has it. Courage also is a fine thing, and yet eminent soldiers and military leaders have been asked, "Were you ever afraid in battle?" And the answer, if they were honest, has usually been, "Of course, I was always afraid in battle. I'd be a fool not to be afraid in battle. There is danger in battle." We too must learn that there are battle situations for us in which we must be afraid, some of us more than others. It is no great credit to me as an individual that I am not tempted by alcohol. I have my own temptations. I am tempted by tobacco. I'm tempted by food, and there's just as much intemperance in giving way to those temptations as there is in giving way to the temptation which, to some of you and many others, is or has been alcohol. So we in the medical profession appreciate that we have a partnership with you. We need a partnership with you, as you do with us, to solve this problem of alcoholism. You have arrived by your own separate paths at some of the same solutions that medicine has arrived at in the treatment of alcoholism. We have learned, for example, as you have learned, the value of group therapy in many situations. I suppose the earliest indication of group therapy in medicine, at least in modern medicine, was expectant mothers' classes, where a lot of young pregnant women went together and learned all about what was happening to them and why and what to do about it. Then the idea spread, and a very courageous doctor, who was almost laughed out of the profession, decided that there was no good reason why a man should not learn how to mix a formula and change a diaper. So we had expectant fathers' classes. And then we found group therapy, a very potent factor in the field of mental and emotional health. In some of our mental institutions, the device of play acting is used in order to allow people to express their latent hostility, if not in a constructive way, at least harmlessly. We have even applied group therapy to one of our other great temptations, the area of food. And it has been seriously suggested that Fatties Anonymous, or something like that, be organized. I would dislike to see AA paraphrased too often, and in regard to lesser issues. But the fact is that overweight people can diet more cheerfully in groups than they can by themselves. I noticed in one of your bulletin items something about a lone member, and I can imagine how much more difficult it must be for lone members than it is for your groups, because the lone members do not have the direct support and sympathy of others who know what their problem is. In medicine, we have learned a great deal about the physical treatment of the alcoholic. We have learned about nutrition and the importance of a fully rounded diet and vitamins and minerals. We do not regard these as cures for alcoholism, for we don't believe anymore that lack of vitamins is the cause of alcoholism. That's altogether too simple. But we do know that these things are necessary in the physical treatment and rehabilitation of the alcoholic. We know also that various kinds of drying out and other forms of therapy have failed. They are not enough by themselves. We need something more. We know also that religious exhortation has failed, as has exhortation from people who have no grasp of the problem, who oversimplify. People in whose view an alcoholic is a person who is perpetually thirsty with a fierce craving for alcohol. People who do not know that a great many alcoholics hate alcohol worse than poison when they are sober because they know that it is poison. We have learned the futility of long-term pledges, which are so very, very difficult to keep. All these things you, more than any other group that I know anything about, have taught us. I have a great many friends in AA. I suspect I have more friends in AA than I know anything about, because perhaps some of my friends have not yet told me that they are AAs. I can recall after some of the broadcasts we made, being stopped on the street in the village where I live, near Chicago, by people whom I had known for many years, and having them express to me a brief word of thanks for the broadcast. I was astonished at these people, but as time went on, I became less and less astonished as I saw the effectiveness of your work, as I saw a man of great talent, a close friend of mine, a man in a creative line which I will not identify because it might possibly identify him, a man who was almost on the verge of genius. I saw alcohol make its insidious inroads upon his career, upon his relationships with his family and children, upon his standing in the community. I saw his wife covering up for him. I saw her describing his frequent illnesses, which we gradually came to know were illnesses, but not of the kind she wanted us to believe. I saw him on the verge of losing his job, and I saw him lose his job, and then I saw him surrender. I saw him throw up his hands and quit, saying, "I can't do it by myself. I've got to have help." And with the spiritual help of his clergyman and AA, I have seen that man come back to a commanding position in his field, a man who is as sober today, as clear-eyed and bright as any person in this audience. I am confident he's going to stay that way. That is only one of a number that I have seen and that other doctors have seen too. So, more and more, we are beginning to realize that you have in your principles surrender, humility, looking above for divine guidance, day-by-day sobriety, and above all, anonymity, the insurance that nobody is going to get famous as a leader of Alcoholics Anonymous. These principles are all vitally important. You who have seen what alcohol can do in your lives are working together in groups and individually, and you are making a bigger impression on the problem of alcohol than has ever been made before. We need that impression in this world today, a world in which fear dominates. Alcoholism is an escape. From what? Well, from intolerable situations in your own life, and the whole world is in an intolerable situation today. It is no wonder that alcoholism grows. Not only that, but we are in a social situation where alcoholic temptations are on every hand. I suppose this is the only convention, with perhaps the exception of the strictly religious ones, and not all of them, that is really a dry convention. I don't know whether you are welcome in convention cities. You certainly don't do the bar business any good. People who, when I was a child, would have looked askance at anyone who took a drink are now socially serving cocktails in their homes. Our children are being brought up in a thoroughly alcoholic environment, by billboard, by radio, by television, in advertising of all kinds. The qualities of alcoholic beverages are being extolled. Put those two things together, a world living under the domination of fear, and a world filled with alcohol and with alcoholic suggestion, and you can see how important it is that people realize what alcoholism really is, a deep-seated emotional illness that must be treated according to psychosomatic principles. Psychosomatic, of course, simply means body and soul. We hear a lot about psychosomatic medicine these days, but let me tell you that any doctor who was worth his salt, from the earliest times to the present days, was practicing psychosomatic medicine. Sir William Osler said, "It isn't so important what disease the patient has as what kind of patient has the disease." That's one of the things that you people have realized. So I come to you here with a great sense of appreciation for your having invited me. I come, as I say, to stand humbly before you and admire your great accomplishments, and to say to you that we in the medical profession are confident that these accomplishments will grow bigger and more significant as time goes on, because you have set your feet upon the upward paths. You have held out and are holding out a helping hand to those who need it. I am no psychiatrist, but I have confidence in saying this to you, as I have said to thousands of patients, that the thing we need most of all in this world today is tranquility of mind. Various names have been given to it. Some books about it have been very popular. Some call it the power of positive thinking. Some call it peace of mind. Some call it peace of soul. But I'm inclined to go along with Billy Graham and call it peace with God. Those are the things we need. And an organization like yours, in a world that seems to have gone materialistically mad, gives us courage to believe that there is still hope, that there is still idealism, and that we are going to win out over many, many of our problems, one of the most serious of which is alcoholism. Chairman, I am a jack of all trades and master of none, namely, a general practitioner. So I am a member of the American Academy of General Practice, which has its headquarters here in St. Louis. I had to get that plug in. AA in its early days was nurtured by three outstanding doctors. You have heard Bill mention Dr. Silkworth. We all know our friend Dr. Harry Thibault. And I would like at this time to mention our own G. Kirby Collier of New York State, who was instrumental in getting Bill W. to address the American Psychiatric Association, at which time he gave that very fine paper, Medicine Looks at Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a milestone in medical history. So at this time, I would like to pay a special tribute to G. Kirby Collier, who left us a year or so ago. Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Thibault, and Dr. Collier were great workers for AA in its formative years, and we cannot say too much for any of these three men. The next speaker, in my opinion, is a great physician. First, he is a doctor of medicine, and then he has pursued that special branch of medicine called psychiatry. He has written many inspiring articles, the most recent one of which I would call to your attention, The Ego Factors in the Surrender of Alcoholism. We had some reprints of this piece that we passed around to members of our groups in Rochester. We think it is one of the finest things that has been written in recent years. Of course, all of us alcoholics are endowed with this ego, which Dr. Thibault so effectively describes. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Bill's friend of long standing, a great friend of AA, a fine physician, scientist, and research man, Dr. Harry Thibault of Greenwich, Connecticut. Dr. Harry M. Thibault. Under ordinary circumstances, I should thank the man who introduced me for his very nice remarks. But for years, I've been teaching the need for ego reduction, and I'm not sure that my ego got sufficiently reduced by the introduction. When the invitation came to speak before this group, I immediately said, yes, I want to go. For many years, as you all know, I have been associated with AA, and all the experiences that I had had came flashing through my mind. So there was so much to say that I didn't know quite where to begin. With your permission, I'm going to use a manuscript, so that the points I want to make will not be forgotten. At an AA meeting, the speaker, as a rule, identifies himself as an alcoholic and then proceeds to tell his story, sprinkling wisdom or humor or both as he goes along. I shall also tell my story, although I am less sure of matching either the wit or the wisdom of the AA speakers. I joined AA by proxy in 1939, when a patient of mine became a member of the New York group. Well do I remember my first meeting. It was tense with excitement. AA was going on the air for the first time. One of the members, trying to rehabilitate himself, had talked with Gabriel Heater, who, on hearing his story, suggested that he, the AA man, appear on the program We the People. This was the night of his appearance, and it was far too thrilling and special for settling down to a regular meeting. The actual event was a bit of a letdown. The man from AA spoke briefly of his experiences, and it was over. AA, however, had taken a step toward making itself known, not a very big step, to be sure, but one of the many which finally led to its present position on the national and international scene. Later, I attended other meetings, more orthodox in character, and as I did, I developed the conviction that this group had hit upon a method which solved the problem of excessive drinking. In a sense, it was an answer to my prayers. After years of butting my head against the problem of treating the alcoholic, I could now begin to hope. In that respect, my first 2 or 3 years of contact with AA were the most exciting in my whole professional life. AA was then in its miracle phase. Everything that happened seemed strange and wonderful. Hopeless drunks are being lifted out of the gutter. Individuals who had sought every known means of help without success were responding to this new approach. To be close to any such group, even by proxy, was electrifying. In addition, from a professional point of view, a whole new avenue of treatment for the problems of alcohol had opened up. Somewhere in the AA experience was the key to sobriety. Here was the first authentic clue after many years of fruitless effort. The possibilities ahead were most intriguing. Perhaps I could learn how AA worked, and thus learn something about how people stopped drinking. Yes, I shared in that general excitement of those days. I could see some daylight ahead. My future in this regard was now clear. I would try to discover what made AA tick. In this quest for understanding, I would never have gotten beyond first base if it had not been for Bill and many of the early members. A study of the 12 steps helped a little, but of far greater importance were the many insights already possessed by Bill and the others into the process through which AA brought about its results. I heard of the need to hit bottom, of the necessity for accepting a higher power, of the indispensability of humility. These were ideas which had never crossed my professional horizon, and certainly had never influenced my non-professional thinking or attitudes. Revolutionary as they were, they nevertheless made sense, and I found myself embarked on a tour of discovery. I began to recognize more clearly what hitting bottom really implied, and I began to do what I could to induce the experience in others, always wondering what was happening inside the individual as he went through the crisis of hitting the bottom. Finally, fortune smiled on me again, this time from another patient. For some time, she had been under my new brand of psychotherapy designed to promote hitting bottom. For reasons completely unknown, she experienced a mild but typical conversion, which brought her into a positive state of mind. Led by the newly found spiritual elements, she started attending various churches in town. One Monday morning, she entered my office, her eyes ablaze, and at once commenced talking. "I know what happened to me. I heard it in church yesterday. I surrendered." With that word, surrender, she handed me my first real awareness of what happens during the period of hitting bottom. The individual alcoholic was always fighting an admission of being licked, of admitting that he was powerless. If and when he surrendered, he quit fighting, admitted he was licked, and accepted the fact that he was powerless and needed help. If he did not surrender, 1,000 crises could hit him and nothing constructive would happen. The need to induce surrender became a new therapeutic goal. The miracle of AA was now a little clearer, though the reason was still obscure why the program and the fellowship of AA could induce a surrender, which could in turn lead to a period of no drinking. As might be expected, I enjoyed a thrill of my own. I was getting in on what was happening, all of it an enjoyable experience. Still questing eagerly, I shifted my therapeutic attack. The job now was to induce surrender. But I ran into a whole nest of resistances to that idea. Totally new territory had to be explored. As I continued my tour, it became ever more apparent that in everyone's psyche there existed an unconquerable ego which bitterly opposed any thought of defeat, until that ego was somehow reduced or rendered ineffective, no likelihood of surrender could be anticipated. The shift in emphasis in hitting bottom to surrender to ego reduction occurred during the first 5 or 6 years of my initial contact with AA. I well remember the first AA meeting to which I spoke on the subject of ego reduction. AA, still very much in its infancy, was celebrating a 3rd or 4th anniversary of one of the groups. The speaker, immediately preceding me, told in detail of the efforts of his local group, which consisted of 2 men, to get him to dry up and become its 3rd member. After several months of vain efforts on their part and repeated nosedives on his, the speaker went on to say, "Finally, I got cut down to size, and I've been sober ever since." When my turn came to speak, I used his phrase, "cut down to size," as a text around which to weave my remarks. Before long, out of the corner of my eye, I was conscious of a disconcerting stare. It was coming from the previous speaker. Looking a little more directly, I could see his eyes fixed on me in wonder. It was perfectly clear that he was utterly amazed that he had said anything that would make sense to a psychiatrist. The look of incredulity never left his face during my entire talk. The incident had one value in my eyes. It showed the 2 people, one approaching the matter clinically and the other relying on his own intuitively experienced report of what had happened to him, both came up with exactly the same observation, the need for ego reduction. During the past decade, my own endeavors have centered primarily upon this problem of ego reduction. How far I have been able to explore the territory is not at all certain. I have made, however, a little progress, and in the minutes remaining, I shall try, first, to acquaint you with some of my findings, and second, to relate them to the AA scene as I see it. As I have already stated, the fact of hitting bottom to produce a surrender, which cut the ego to size, was evident fairly soon. In time, 2 additional facts manifested themselves. The first was that a reduced ego has marvelous recuperative powers. The second was that surrender is an essential disciplinary function and experience. The first is merely repeating a fact known to you all. It is common knowledge that a return of the full-fledged ego can happen at any time. Years of sobriety are no insurance against its resurgence. No AA, regardless of his veteran status, can ever relax his guard against the encroachments of a reviving ego. Recently, one AA, writing to another, reported that he was suffering, he feared, from halotosis, a reference to the smugness and self-complacency which so easily can creep into the individual with years of sobriety behind him. The assumption that one has all the answers, and the contrary, that one needs to know no answers, but just to follow AA, are 2 indicators of trouble. In both cases, open-mindedness is notably absent. Perhaps the commonest manifestation of the return of ego is witnessed in the individual who falls from his pink cloud, a state of mind familiar to you all. The blissful pink cloud state is a logical aftermath of surrender. The ego, which is full of striving, just quits, and the individual senses peace and quiet within. The result is an enormous feeling of release, and the person flies right up to his pink cloud and thinks he has found heaven on earth. Everyone knows he is doomed for a fall, but it is perhaps not equally clear that it is the ego slowly making its comeback which forces the descent from the pink cloud into the arena of life, where, with the help of AA, he can learn how to become a sober person and not an angel. I could go on with many more examples familiar to you all to show you the danger of ever assuming that the ego is dead and buried. Its capacity for rebirth is utterly astounding and must never be forgotten. My second finding, that surrender is a disciplinary experience, requires explanation. In recent articles, I have shown that the ego, basically, must be forging continuously ahead, and that it operates on the unconscious assumption that it, the ego, should never be stopped. It takes for granted that it is right to go ahead. It has no expectation of ever being stopped, and hence no capacity to adjust to that eventuality. Stopping says, in effect, no, you cannot continue, which is the essence of disciplinary control. The individual who cannot take a stopping is fundamentally an undisciplined person. The function of surrender in AA is now clear. It produces that stopping by causing individuals to say, I quit. I give up my headstrong ways. I've learned my lesson. Very often, for the first time in that individual's adult career, he has encountered the necessary discipline which halts him in his headlong pace. And this happens because we can surrender and truly feel, Thy will, not mine, be done. When that is true, we have become, in fact, obedient servants of God. The spiritual point at that moment is a reality. We have become members of the human race. I have now presented the two points I wish to make. Namely, first, the ego is revivable. And second, surrender is a disciplinary experience. I next wish to discuss their significance to AA as I see it. Primarily, they say quite simply that AA can never be just a miracle. The single act of surrender can produce sobriety by its stopping effect upon the ego. Unfortunately, that ego will return unless the individual learns to accept a disciplined way of life, which means that a tendency for ego comeback is permanently checked. This is not new to AA members. They have learned that a single surrender is not enough. Under the wise leadership of the Founding Fathers, the need for continued endeavor to maintain that miracle has been steadily stressed. The 12 steps, repeated inventories, not just one, and the 12th step itself, a routine reminder that one must work at deserving sobriety, are all essential. Moreover, it is referred to as 12-step work, which is exactly what it is. But this time, the miracle is for the other fellow. It is referred to as 12-step work, which is exactly what it is. But this time, the miracle is for the other fellow.